Tom's going to want to cover here. So.
Then I have a...
Vicki also just wanted to clarify one area on the trending reports with you as well.
Great. Are we back on the record?
We can go back on.
I'm back on the record. It's 12:46 p.m.
Why don't we go ahead and you have some clarification of something related to the trending reports?
Okay. That is, you asked me, I believe the question was the data correct on the trending
reports? Yes, they were
accurate. They're accurate. Mm-hmm. And they were. The data, the underlying data was, we were just going through working those up. As I said, they were work in progress, first generation. And we did notice things around data, that clients that waived more loans, that may have been because they had more credit overlays, and so that there were some there were things that it wasn't an apples to apples comparison of client to client.
I see. So, but the information you gave to Deutsche Bank, to your knowledge, didn't contain any errors.
That's correct.
The information that the Deutsche loan numbers are accurate.
Yes.
The
yes.
reports had an aspect to them, as I understand them, of trying to do comparisons to averages and trying to see if we could compare apples to apples. And that's the areas where they do the comparisons. That was the work in progress. The raw data is the raw data.
Yes.
I think what you're interested in, what are exception rates and EB3s and that kind of data is the data.
And just so I understand, what exactly then did you provide to Deutsche Bank, to which Mr. Camerato and others had issues with?
The booklet, the presentation of trending reports.
That's the one that's in the materials you have.
We were talking about some of it as Deutsche specific numbers, and others are trying to compare apples to apples.
Yes.
Did that book contain both types of information? I mean, what was it, I guess, in that book?
It showed, I'd have to look at one to see, but we had, I believe, a column that showed like a Clayton average.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that average could, different clients had different ways of, having event three loans. Some were more conservative than others, so that was the piece that marks.
You'll see when you look at them, you print them out, when they talk about the Clayton averages, it's almost different in every report.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was changing every time they ran one. So that's one of the things where that's sort of the work in progress, trying to figure that stuff out. Mm-hmm. The Clayton, the client numbers themselves,
that is accurate.
And which portion of the report did the Deutsche Bank representatives object to?
I don't recall because we were going through it before Mr. Camerato came in the room. I'm not sure what it was.
Do you recall anything being said about our early payment defaults?
No.
Just so I understand, what was your view of the utility of these reports for your client?
To be able to look at the sellers, they were routinely their top five sellers if they were going back month over month so that it would combine it into quarters to see if their exceptions were going up, going down, where they were, the concentration of exceptions, was it credit, was it compliance, and then what were they in the categories?
And when you walked away from your meeting with Deutsche Bank and Mr. Camerato, what was your understanding and how would you articulate their concerns with the reports?
I think, and this is strictly my opinion, I think it was because of the it showed a waiver rate. I don't remember what the waiver rate was, but I think it was higher than the Clayton average, possibly. I'd have to look at that. But it was the fact that he knew that their transaction management team was very conservative, and a lot of loans were graded threes, which then resulted in, more two Ws. And I think he didn't like the presentation of that.
I see. So if I can maybe articulate that, their standards going in, he believed, were higher, and therefore, even though there showed to be a lot more exceptions, their initial standards were higher versus perhaps another institution that might have lower standards initially, and therefore fewer exceptions.
Yes, correct. Yes.
So that's the apples to apples.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's the difficulty in apples to apples.
And we saw that.
Mm-hmm. With this data, which is what Mark made that point before.
Mm-hmm. Is the data useful, though, comparing within an institution versus across an institution. In other words, would it be useful to Deutsche Bank to understand how it viewed exceptions over time?
Yes, we thought it would be.
And in terms of a comparison within an organization, that would be a fair use of the information.
Yes.
Okay. You spoke briefly about the concept of 2W, and I wanted to go back to the genesis of 2W. Mm-hmm. Why was the nomenclature of 2W developed?
It was developed, when we didn't have exception tracking, before exception tracking, we just had the 1-2-3 grading. So a loan would be, if a loan was a 3, we would note in the comments if a client said, this loan is a 3, they saw it, and they want us to change it to a 2. And it would be in the comments, but it would be a 2 that would just look like a 2 that Clayton had graded a 2. And so we wanted a distinction between that just for tracking.
Did anyone ever express within Clayton, any colleagues of yours within Clayton, ever express that the 2W nomenclature and system would be a way to, in essence, protect Clayton should anyone later question why something was rated a 2?
I don't remember having the conversation, but I know as a client service manager, I appreciated it because I would often get questioned, as I would work with, say, Lehman, and I would work with one of their transaction managers on a deal of, why is this loan a 2? And I would go back and I would say, well, because, someone on your team said it's a 2. And so we would have it in the comments, but we wouldn't be able to see that differentiation between a 2 and a 2W at that time. So, personally, I was glad of that. Mm-hmm.
Did there ever come a point in time that you personally became concerned or nervous about the number of 3s that were changed to 2Ws, either by any particular institution or even broadly just across the industry?
No, because I didn't know the whole picture of what was going on at our clients, how they were using the data or what they were doing, whether they were buying or purchasing or pricing, or I didn't understand that side of it.
Mm-hmm. I'd be interested, and I do understand the caveats that always go with opinions, but I'd be interested in just your opinions, and I know Tom touched on this, in terms of the amount of attention and scrutiny that were applied by particular clients. And Tom touched on this, but I want to try to break down and get more specific. In terms of the clients that you had that were purchasing pools of loans, bulk purchases of pools of loans, were there any clients that you felt were less diligent or had less attention to scrutiny and quality than other clients? And I would presume there might be a spectrum there of your clients, some of which may no longer be in business and some of which may still be in business, but how would you say in terms of the spectrum? You probably have a good sense of how your clients were. Who were the clients that took more risk in terms of mortgages, and who were more selective in terms of the mortgages that were being purchased?
Well, I don't know if I can say, the clients that really took more risk, because as I said, I didn't know what they were doing with all of our data, and I didn't know the final, did they buy all these loans? I didn't know that. Even if loans were graded a 2W, I still didn't know if that meant they bought the loans or if it was just a way of marking them and then they had further discussions, at their offices. But I do know that it's in my work as a lead, as a client service manager and team leader over some of the teams, I can tell you the clients, and then maybe some will come to me that weren't quite as thorough in the work they did with us, in the things like the credit overlays, the fact that we worked with some clients. We had very extensive custom scripts. In other words, we had our standard Clayton script that we could do a deal if you came to us, And then some clients, we worked with them week after week to tweak the system, make it better, put more fields in, more, you know. And the ones that really did that that I thought were very good were Deutsche Bank, Lehman, Credit Suisse. I really thought they were really good. Some that I felt like maybe not quite as good, maybe Bayer, Nomura might have been one. And some of it could have been their structure. It could have been the way they structured. Citigroup, we didn't do a lot of deals for Citigroup, but Citi, we kind of, they didn't seem at that time when we were doing deals, and that was early on in 2003, they didn't seem to have that transaction management layer of people. Now, that could have changed over the years when we didn't do as much work for them. But, that would be the best way I could tell you, was that those were the people that really, you know, I thought were just very hands-on, very into it, had teams of people looking at data, or individuals, you know, that's all they seemed to do was look at reports and data, and really took it seriously.
And you mentioned Goldman earlier. Where would Goldman fall in that spectrum?
Goldman, I would say, would be up at the top. They always had transaction managers on site. They were one of the clients that it was rare that we went to a deal when they didn't have someone there that was actually looking at the loans also. Mm-hmm. So maybe not as much like with their script or their reporting, but they were maybe a little bit more toward the middle.
And do you have enough information to form an opinion about Countrywide?
As I said, Countrywide, I didn't do as much work with them. They didn't use Clayton as much during the years where we were doing more volume. They were using other diligence firms. I do know that they had the structure that you mentioned, where I think they had the different groups that were either buying loans or that were looking at loans for securitization. Or, you know, I think they had different people we would work with, different transaction managers. I really couldn't say for them.
At Citigroup, who do you recall you encountering at Citigroup or interacting with there? Mm-hmm. And was it Citi Mortgage, the entity at Citigroup? Do you remember?
You know, it was. We always called them different. We called them Citi mostly. Mm-hmm. Was what we called them. I think they were Citigroup. It was the people I worked with there were Phil Sears, Matt Bolo. Mm-hmm. And there were a couple of guys that had the name John, and I can't remember their last names, but yeah, so I worked with them some.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Now, you caught my attention earlier, speaking of Citigroup and mentioning the savings and loan that you were affiliated with in Beaumont, Texas. Uh-huh. Did you happen to come across a gentleman there named Richard Bowen who ended up at Citigroup?
You know, I don't recognize that name. He was at First Federal?
That's my recollection. He ended up at Citi Mortgage, and that's why I was wondering.
I don't recognize it.
And going back to the Moody's meetings that you had, did you also attend meetings with the other rating agencies?
I attended one meeting at S&P. With Frank Phillips and Jeff Wilson, where we went. I did. Yeah, we went to the city.
Now, why did you meet with the rating agencies? What was your purpose? Were these meetings that you called or that the rating agencies called?
I know the meeting with Moody's, and then we had another meeting with Moody's in the city with a group of their people that I attended also. The meeting in Shelton was, I can't really say this with, you know, I'm not positive, but I think I remember that Moody's asked for us to show them our process. And so we went through, you know, a lot of the things I told you today about how we set up deals, the logistics, how we, start a deal. And then we actually underwrote a loan file. on our Clayton, you know, laptop with the loan file cracked. And then we went to the city and we had a meeting there regarding regulatory compliance and the way we grade loans and, you know, reviewed loans for regulatory compliance.
And when you say you have a meeting in the city, this is with Moody's?
With Moody's, yes. And I don't know, again, I don't know, I think they asked us if we would come and talk to them about that. So we did. And then the S&P meeting was, we met with several people at Moody's and talked about data, and, you know, the importance of the quality of data and the use of data and how we, again, kind of walk through our process and how we capture data and furnish data comparisons back to clients, that kind of thing.
And that's the S&P meeting you were
yes.
describing there as well?
Mm-hmm.
And the Moody's meeting in the city, do you recall if it was attended by Moody's CEO, Raymond McDaniels?
You know, I don't recall, but I don't think it was. I think, again, it was more maybe a director level or two, and then more of their analysts. It was almost, my remembrance of it was they were trying to expose some of their analysts to, like, the process maybe that we did, or kind of an education.
Mm-hmm. At either the S&P or the Moody's meetings, did Clayton ever try to offer any information or services to the rating agencies, which the rating agencies then rejected?
No.
I want to ask you, going back in time, you caught my attention earlier about your work with Freddie and Fannie, and I was just wondering if you could elaborate when you worked with Fannie and Freddie, and what was the type of work during these time frames?
When I worked with Fannie and Freddie was at this, when I worked at the savings and loan, I was in loan servicing at the time. And so my work with them was more around furnishing delinquency, you know, numbers, that kind of thing, and then around if we had any, you know, we didn't have a lot of foreclosures at the time, and but if we had, you know, like claim type work, that kind of thing, it was more like that, more around if we had assumptions, getting them, you know, documents to update files, that kind of thing, more of a servicing function.
So you never worked with Fannie or Freddie vis-a-vis Clayton Holdings?
Yes, I did. I worked, I mean, as when I was a project lead, and then our CSM team also, we did some work for Freddie Mac reviewing some loans, some, you know, I think they were subprime loans.
And if I recall you saying earlier, this was somewhere around 1993 that you were reviewing the subprime loans?
No,
for Freddie?
No, that was when I was at the savings and loan.
I'm sorry. So when were you reviewing subprime loans for Freddie?
You know, that would have been, I get my years mixed up, like 1998, 99 to about 2002, somewhere in there. It could have been a little bit later, but I do remember 2000. Well, you know what? It went through my very first part of 2003 because I was going to do a Freddie Mac job the next week, but then I went to Shelton and to Clayton and Shelton. So.
And so you said 98, 99, and then maybe through up to 2003.
Yeah,
so
it could have. Yeah, through 2003. It could have been not as early as 98, 99. It may have been more like 2000. I can't really remember.
And the mortgages, the work that Clayton was doing for Freddie mm-hmm. was reviewing pools of subprime loans that Freddie was purchasing?
I assume they were purchasing them. We were reviewing them. Yeah, I didn't. But, yes, I remember we went to the ones I was on were mainly at option one. We looked at loans at option one with them.
Did anyone at Freddie ever express to you the reason that Freddie was purchasing the subprime loans, the motivations for purchasing the subprime loans?
No.
Did anyone ever discuss with you from Freddie the types of mortgages or that would count for affordable housing goals that Freddie had vis-a-vis the HUD regulations?
No, I never discussed that with you.
So you don't know if these purchases were for the were designed, excuse me, you don't know if the pools of mortgages that you were reviewing were being reviewed with the eye toward meeting affordable housing goals.
Correct.
You've been in the mortgage industry a long time, and I'd be interested to hear your thoughts in terms of how we got to what many have described as the largest housing bubble in history. I'd be just curious to know your opinions and thoughts as a participant in this market for a long time. How do you think we got into this housing bubble?
Well, I think it was very similar if you look back at what happened where I was, you know, with what happened locally or a little more regionally with the RTC. I think we got into, and then it was because of high interest rates. Rates were so high. You came up with these new products. And to me, I mean, guidelines are guidelines, and guidelines aren't a true measure of risk to me, because you can meet guidelines and it's still not a good loan, you know, or you can not meet guidelines and that loan may perform, but you still need guidelines. But I think when you start with a lot of the products that come out, and then especially if you put the wrong borrower in those products, that's, I really do think that. I think, you know, so you had, you know, first-time home buyers on stated income. So there you did have some guideline stuff going on, you know. But you had, you know, going into interest-onlys and, you know, or pay option arms. And while they're good products for the right people, I don't think, in my opinion, they're not good products for typical subprime borrowers.
Well, why do you think these products became more prevalent in this past decade? Any sense of, in your opinion, the reason why?
I think to have a product that you could get a borrower into, you know, get make them a loan, you know, they would have a loan they could qualify for. That's my opinion.
There have been several theories that have been proposed relating to the reasons for the housing bubble. Mm-hmm. One theory involves the GSEs and the GSEs' purchases of subprime mortgages and Alt-A mortgages with the view to meet their own affordable housing goals. The theory, as I understand it, is that as Fannie and Freddie expanded what they would purchase, expanded their underwriting to purchase more subprime and Alt-A products, it in essence pushed underwriting lower and lower, particularly on the private sector, whereby loans that used to be reserved just for the private label were now being purchased by Fannie and Freddie, and therefore private label were having to dip lower and lower in quality, lower and lower in the FICO curve. I'd be interested to know if you share that theory, if you've observed anything that could support that theory, or if you've observed anything that would refute that theory.
Well, I mean, I'll just tell you again, just my personal observation. I wondered sometimes when I would look at loans that had high FICOs and verified assets and reserves and full doc, I would wonder why they were at, you know, one of the subprime shops. And I just, you know, I don't know if maybe it was, and this was just me coming up through the mortgage industry, was it because it was quicker, it was easier to get the loan? Because I remember in the days when we were, you know, doing FHA, VA loans, or even Fannie Freddie, you know, at First Federal in Beaumont, you didn't get a loan. I mean, getting a loan was a process. I mean, you know, you waited a month or 2 months to get approved for your loan, and then it was like, you know, you were seeing loans, you know, a week before, 2 weeks before, and man, they're done. I wondered, I will say personally, just to myself, wondered why these loans were at Option One or New Century instead of, you know, and was it because it was quicker? It was, I don't know that, but I did wonder.
And as Fannie and Freddie were purchasing subprime loans, did you or your colleagues, to your knowledge, observe any decrease in the underwriting guidelines and the private label side? Mm-hmm. As Fannie was getting into subprime, did that change things on the private label side with your clients?
No, I never noticed that.
Never noticed. No. There's another theory that has been proposed by commentators, mm-hmm. For the reason of the subprime bubble, yeah. housing bubble, and that is that Wall Street banks were greedy and they would purchase more and more and lower quality mortgages as time went on, that their standards dropped, and thereby they caused an increase in demand on the secondary market for these mortgages. The idea being, I believe, that if you're originating a mortgage as a subprime originator, you got to find a place to sell it if it's an originate-to-distribute type model, and that Wall Street banks were demanding these mortgages, and they couldn't get enough of them, and therefore they lowered and lowered and lowered their quality and underwriting as time went on. Is that a theory that you observed? Have you observed any evidence that supports that theory, or have you observed any evidence that would refute that theory?
You know, during that time, it was like we were, you know, I was working in the deals and things, and like I say, I didn't know what was going on. Even as closely as I worked with Lehman, I mean, I knew they did things like, you know, they got their own valuations, they got our data, but I never saw the end result of how they used that data or what they did or how they bought loans. You know, I didn't see it. Now, I've read things, of course, now, mm-hmm. but at the time, I didn't. Mm-hmm. I mean, I felt like, really, the people I worked with, I thought they were doing, you know, they were really being diligent about their efforts mm-hmm. to look at these loans and, you know.
So if I understand correctly, you didn't observe anything that would lead you to believe that Wall Street banks were lowering their standards in terms of what they would purchase?
No, because I wasn't ever sure what they purchased.
Hmm. But in terms of the interactions
yeah.
that you did
yeah.
have, I know you didn't know what they purchased,
yeah.
but
yeah.
were there any signals that they made
no.
to you that would suggest that they were lowering their
no.
standards
no.
over time?
Did we ever establish a date for that meeting with Deutsche Bank? Was it in June or July of 2007? Do you remember?
I think it was September, I believe. I would have to...
You think it was September 2007?
I think it was September 2007.
Okay.
I can confirm that.
I probably asked this before, but do you recall what was said to you in that meeting with Deutsche Bank?
No, it was more just that feeling of, you know.
Did anybody, Michael Comitato or anyone else, say anything about that report or how the report might have been erroneous or how they would challenge it?
No.
Okay. A couple of questions here.
Let me just finish up a couple more thoughts that I had. 2006, according to some data that we've seen, suggests that may have been the worst of the years in terms of delinquencies and defaults of mortgages. And I was wondering if you, and through your work, observed anything particular about 2006 that would help us understand and explain that.
You know, I know that I wasn't a client service manager in 2006. I was a team lead, so I didn't have my hands as much in the individual deals or the data. I was more about, you know, best practices, getting information out to our leads, you know, educating our client service managers. But, I mean, I know that we typically went out, you know, month after month for clients to the same places. There were a lot of forward commitments, I think they called them, where they would buy the production for the next 3 months or, you know. And, you know, I mean, I know the volume grew and it was the, you know, the usual, you know, we were going to the same sellers typically, or originators, you know, repeatedly for clients. That's the best I could say about the growth and how busy, you know, that, you know, there was just a lot of product, it seemed.
Did you,
a lot of transactions.
Did any of your counterparts at your clients,
transaction managers, and they may have called them due diligence managers, but we typically call them transaction managers.
Did any transaction managers ever express to you or anyone else, to your knowledge, that they were receiving any sort of pressure to buy more and more mortgages from their supervisors? Did they ever express anything to that effect to you about the pressure that they received internally to buy mortgages?
No, I never did hear that.
We have a monumental task in terms of understanding the causes of the financial crisis, and housing is a big one. And it's just more open-ended question in terms of any thoughts or suggestions that you have for us, any theories that you've always wondered about, any hints that you wished someone would follow up on. Here's your opportunity to tell the people who are tasked by Congress to follow up on them. Just an open-ended thing. Anything else that you can tell us that might help us at all?
Well, I think, and I didn't mention when I said what were my thoughts on what happened, I think another thing was, you know, the value of the property and the belief that the value of the property would continue to go up and continue to go up. That was another big thought I had, and I worried about that only because I had been through what happened at the savings and loan that I was at and saw what could happen when, you know, people couldn't even sell their house now for what it was worth, you know. So I think with all that and what I've been through and seen, I think it was, you know, that like the legislation that got passed yesterday, I think that will be good. I hope we don't have to go too far so that you stifle things, so that there's no available credit and liquidity in the market, so that we can get back to more of a normal basis. But I am glad to see that, because I think that as with regulatory compliance, and you look at a lot of our reports and things, you didn't see over time as many exceptions, say in high cost and predatory lending, because it did have some regulation and people took it very seriously and they had to adhere to that, because you didn't want, you know, like the headline risk, or say you bought loans that had, you know, the predatory lending or the high cost loans. And so I think some things they're doing around, you know, appraisers and brokers and that kind of thing. I can certainly tell you I hope we've learned this time from that, and I hope that some of the things that are put in place make it better.
Did you come across any appraisers that were problematic, or do you believe that were engaged in any potential fraud or improper dealing?
You know, we didn't really track, like, you know, appraisers as a party or like a, you know, but so we never had that data to put that together. I know some of our clients had appraiser watch lists, or the originators, I should say, had appraiser watch lists, and they tended to do that on the front end at the origination. But, you know, we would make exceptions if we felt that, you know, the value wasn't supported or the appraisal wasn't properly completed.
Did Clayton use an automated valuation model, an AVM?
We would run that. We could run that for our clients. Many of our clients ran them. They didn't always give us their results.
Run them for clients in connection with your due diligence reviews for those clients to get a second opinion with respect to the appraisals on the properties?
For some clients, yes.
And was that a service that you held out, Clayton held out to them?
Yes.
One task that we have been asked to look into by Congress is the incidences of fraud in the mortgage lending area. I know there seems to be categories of fraud.
Yes.
Some have described it as fraud for housing.
Yeah.
In other words, the borrower lying about his or her income or credit quality. Fraud for profit, as it's described, as the lender or mortgage broker lying on mortgage documents. And then there seems to be also a category of that might not be fraud, but might be just targeting borrowers that may otherwise shouldn't be in a loan or loan product. These sorts of products like option arms, negative amortization, and the like. And we're trying to get a sense of the incidences in those different categories. You know, whether fraud grew over time, and what type of fraud. Is there any data or any information that either Clayton has or that you observe that help us get a sense of how that changed over time, those categories?
I think, you might be able to possibly look at some of the trending reports that we put together in May show, like if you had the category for income and you could go down to the exception level and look at income, does it seem reasonable, which we would select, you might be able to look at that and see, but not really at that broad level. We don't have, that's where we were trying to go, as I was telling Steve and Mark yesterday, with the trending reports, the fact that we had data and try to get some analytics around that data, but then about the time we were starting to do that kind of work, the market,
Do you have an opinion on, based on your observations, how those buckets change? Fraud for housing, fraud for profit, and just almost what some may deem predatory lending. How those buckets changed over time? Did there become more fraud for profit, or was it more fraud for housing? Do you have any sense or observations on that? Anecdotally or based on anything that you observed?
To think about it. When I think of inflating income, whether you do it by, fraudulently doctoring up W-2s and pay stubs, or it's just in stated income where you say they make this and they don't. You've got a little of both, because to me, the borrower, if they knew about that was going on, they were getting fraud for housing, but then it was profit to the originator. So I'd have to look at it both ways. I've looked at deals in the past where we've looked at things like that, looked at, way many years ago before all this, where we looked at loans that had early pay defaults because, the originator or the broker would make the loans and then pay the first few payments, to get through the reps and warranty period and then not make them. So you've got all kind of things. And even, I think the timing of it, you had this before also, before 2005, 2006. I think you can, I think it's kind of isolated by maybe certain brokers, certain third parties that get affiliated together. I never felt it was just broad.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a sense, we've heard in terms of percentage of Clayton's business, we've heard that Clayton had 70% of review of samples from mortgage brokers, but that only accounted for 30% of the total mortgage market. We've heard some statistics like that. Do you have any sense of, what percentage of mortgages Clayton touched? And I understand you're sampling a small sample of a pool, but what pools did Clayton touch? Any sense of the percentage? Has there been any numbers internally generated or anything like that?
No, I know that was always something our marketing group would try to get their hands on. There wasn't really great data out there around mortgages, and then it was something we always wanted to kind of know, but I don't think we ever really figured out.
And the final question for me, was there any question or topic that you expected today that we haven't covered?
Let me see. No, I don't think so.
Well, we've got a couple more questions.
Okay. Yeah,
okay.
Can you look at that document? It's been marked up.
Okay, thank you.
Can you identify that type of a document? Is that something that Clayton provided to his clients?
Are we making this Exhibit 5 for the record?
Say again?
Are we making this Exhibit 5 for the record?
It's part of that combined exhibit that we had before. That will be Exhibit 5, yeah. But
okay.
It's part of,
like,
was it number 2 or something? You know, I have seen this only because of pulling data, but I think this was a very specific report for, I think, Deutsche maybe, or one of our clients, but it's a very specific report that wasn't used by any other clients that I'm aware of.
Do you know whether or not Deutsche did it on every deal, they just did it every now and then?
No, I don't know that.
This is marked for number 5. Let me ask you one other question. I have not asked you. Are you familiar with how Clayton was compensated in connection with his performance of due diligence?
I know that we either had we had three ways at one time, and I'm not even sure now because I don't work in that area, but we had per file, which was all in, just per file plus expense and time and expense, I think were the three ways we were compensated.
Per file plus expense.
Uh-huh. And then time and expense. In other words, just the actual time we put into it, billed out at a rate plus expenses.
Presumably then, if a person bailed out on a deal because they didn't like what they were seeing in terms of loan forms, they still owed you for the time that you had in.
Yes, they took it.
To your knowledge, did any Clayton client or their representative ever remove the W on a 2W report submitted to their senior management?
Not that I'm aware of.
To any regulator?
Not that I'm aware of.
Nobody altered the 2W reports, to your knowledge?
Can you repeat the question?
Yeah.
So, to your knowledge, did any Clayton client or their representative ever remove the W on a 2W on 2W report submitted to their senior management?
You never know.
Yeah, I'm not aware.
Okay. What would have been the effect of removal of a W on a 2W report? Report like that.
Yeah, the effect would have been that if the I think you said to, like, their senior manager, if they had reported it to them, and if they understood our grading system of 1, 2, 2W, 3, 3C, and 3D, they could have thought that by removing the W, it was just a 2.
Okay. And thus it would look like it was
a minor
non-material
exception with compensating factors.
I think now we can say you are done.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
The time is 1:28 p.m.